Thank you, everyone, for letting me speak to you today. And Pastor Susan, for taking this to the next step to say, don't just do something after church. Let's do something in front of the whole congregation. So here I am. We share at least one thing in common with everyone in church today. And as a matter of fact, wherever we go, and with whomever we are with, we share one thing. We were all once children. And one of the wonderful things about adulthood is that many of us have the opportunity to actively engage in the lives of children as teachers, coaches, neighbors, aunts, uncles, parents, grandparents, and even great-grandparents. Further, I know that all of us here today live the words we heard David speak earlier from the Gospel of Mark. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. But childhood for many is not a great time of life. I can certainly remember myself being lonely and misunderstood when I was a boy. However, I also vividly recall times as a child when I knew I was loved and experienced being recognized as worthy. But what if your experience of childhood went something like this? You are 2 years old. Your neighbors, who are sick and tired of the nightly fighting and screaming from your apartment, call the police. Now, if police have reason to believe that public safety is in jeopardy, and if they do not act with expediency, such as in this domestic violence situation, they need not have a court order to enter premises. When they arrive at this situation and gain entry, they encountered a filthy, smoke-filled apartment. There is clearly evidence of drug use. The police encounter a man and a woman, and upon further search, discover two children, ages 2 and 5, in bed together, awake and clearly distraught. The Vermont Department of Children and Families, DCF, is contacted, and the children are taken into state custody, perhaps directly to a standby foster home. The man and the woman are taken to jail on suspicion of drug use and child neglect. Within 3 days, there is an emergency hearing in family court. DCF files a temporary custody order for the children to be placed in the care of grandparents or an aunt and uncle, or if lacking suitable kin, to remain in the care of the foster family. The date for a disposition hearing is set within 30 days. A guardian ad litem, who was on the emergency hearing list for that day, was called early that morning and is present during the hearing as well. I would imagine that to some degree, many of you are aware of the effects of repeated trauma on a child's physiological and psychological development. Let me assure you that it can adversely alter the entire course of one's life. And the earlier such trauma occurs, the more impactful it is. Whatever I thought about the deficiencies of my own childhood, they pale in comparison to the circumstances of the children I just described. You will gain a better understanding of childhood trauma, and this is another public service announcement, and its pervasive effects throughout one's life if you stay after this service for the extraordinary documentary, Resilience. Thank you, Carol Getzky, for bringing it. Where are you, Carol? Oh, thank you. The film is about the adverse childhood experience study, the ACE study, a research conducted by Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I believe it will leave you with a sense of hope that there are ways to mitigate and even reverse the effects of trauma on children. Actually, I'll be a bit more strident. I believe watching this movie should be required of everyone over the age of 18. It will give many people an understanding of the grip their past has on them, and will help parents to be realize the importance of bonding and loving their children. As you may have read in the newsletter or heard otherwise, I'm here before you today to describe my experience as a guardian ad litem and how I came to do this important volunteer work. The literal translation in Latin of guardian ad litem is something like guardian in the court or in the suit. In some states, we are known as court-appointed special advocates or CASA volunteers. Being a GAL is not synonymous with being a big brother or big sister. We are not one of those mentoring programs. Neither are we investigators. Very simply, we represent the best interest of children in the courts, in the family court system. We learn the needs of the child we represent, communicate with the child's social and legal and educational service providers, make suggestions about such services, and provide our opinion to the court regarding the child's needs. In Vermont, there are some 280 of us, and we need more. And I am also a member of the committee that is overseeing a grant from the National Court-Appointed Special Advocate Association to educate the public about what we do and to recruit new guardians. Some of you may recall the evening workshops that Ginny and I did a few years ago in the vestry, using temperament theory to better understand ourselves and our children. I conduct similar workshops for my fellow guardians. It is a bit of a mouthful to always be referring to ourselves as guardian ad litems, so we usually refer to ourselves as gals. When I first heard this terminology, it did not seem very PC to me. But listening to the women in our ranks refer to themselves as gals got me past my fear of being called a sexist. In Vermont, most of us are not attorneys. Until children reach the age of majority, 18, the court can order a child be placed under the supervision of the Department of Children and Families, and that the child be provided an attorney if they cannot afford one, most of the time, as well as a guardian ad litem. The circumstances that give rise to such an order are called CHINS cases, and they fall into three general categories. Children in need of care supervision, children who are abused, children who are neglected, and or children who are beyond the control of their parents, which often means delinquent. And many of the CHINS children fit into one or more of these categories. There is an important distinction between the job of a GAL and the child's attorney. GALs are charged with promoting the child's best interest, while the attorney is required to represent the child's wishes. As we are talking about minors, the attorney does have some flexibility to disagree with the child's wishes. In rare cases, this distinction between the GAL and the attorney may give rise to a disagreement between them about the disposition plan, and both will express this to the court. Many of us today, yet certainly not all, were children who were secure in their homes with loving and supporting caregivers and extended family. We therefore received a good foundation for our future success in school, college, marriage, family, and a career. Hopefully, many of you feel you have had a fulfilling life, certainly not without its challenges, but that early in life you were given the tools you would need to meet and overcome these challenges. For those of you who never took Psychology 101, I want to briefly describe to you the psychologist Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It is depicted as a pyramid divided into five horizontal tiers and is used to describe human motivation. The bottom, broadest tier, represents one's physiological needs, including food, clothing, and shelter. As the largest tier, it mirrors the struggles of the majority of the world's population, regrettably. The next tier, slightly smaller in breadth, slightly higher, is safety and security. This tier addresses protection from harm, physically, mentally, and economically. The next tier up in the ever-narrowing pyramid is love and belonging. This is the tier that children are most motivated by, as they are dependent on the adults in their lives for their sustenance. And it is demonstrated by the fact that kids will cling to abusive parents. Importantly, it is generally the profound stress parents are under in the lower tiers that impacts their ability to be good parents in the first place. The fourth tier is that of esteem, defined by our need for self-esteem and self-respect. It includes developing competency and self-confidence, as well as earning and experiencing the respect of others. The final, smallest tip of the pyramid is self-actualization, defined by Maslow as becoming the most one can be. A self-actualized individual is one who exhibits qualities of truth, beauty, goodness, justice, simplicity, and autonomy. I propose that self-actualization is synonymous with self-love. I'm not talking about narcissism here. I'm simply addressing that little voice inside each of us that says either at one extreme, I believe I am created in the image of God and I am worthy of love. Or at the other extreme, I am a failure. I will never amount to much. I'm anything but godlike. Okay, you know where I'm going with this. Many children who are in the family court system are far from reaching the pinnacle of Maslow's pyramid. Self-love and confidence are not even a light at the end of their tunnel. These children often lack even a rudimentary toolbox to deal with life's challenges. As young adults, these children will usually recreate the cycle of abuse and poverty they came from because it is known and familiar. The family court system tries to interrupt this cycle, and while it is a Sisyphean task, I am amazed by the dedication of so many individuals in the courts and in the Vermont mental health and social support system who celebrate even the smallest improvements they can bring to the lives of children and families. In my work as a gal, I hold the image of always trying to move the child in my care to the next highest level in Maslow's hierarchy. DCF's focus is often the same as mine as guardian, whether or not they are thinking of Maslow when they do their job or not. A DCF social worker is subject to departmental regulations and may not have the flexibility to express themselves in court as freely as I do as a gal. In Vermont, the safety net is not perfect, but anecdotally and empirically, I hear and witness that the judiciary, DCF, and other support systems in Vermont are better at caring for CHINS cases than in many other states. For instance, mental health and counseling for children, their parents, and as families, is available. Programs with names like Reach Up, Three Squares VT, Farm to Family, Dr. Dinosaur, and many others are available to support children and families and break the cycle of trauma, lack of physical and psychological nourishment, and poverty. It is the job of the gal to look at all the support systems a child has and communicate with school officials, foster families, parents, residential treatment facilities, social workers. The list goes on, depending on the circumstances of the case. Often it is the gal who has the most complete picture of the child's circumstance. And when in court, the child's attorney will often rely on the guardian to update them regarding critical issues that have come to light, including milestones achieved. I should emphasize that a comfortable socioeconomic circumstance is not a protection from childhood abuse. Neglect and delinquency, childhood abuse and neglect or delinquency, as these are equal opportunity scourges. For instance, in a case classified as beyond the control of parents, I worked on behalf of a runaway teen in the care of DCF whose parents were decidedly upper class. Certainly, the majority of children in family court come from economically challenged circumstances, but part of the GAL's training is to have a sensitivity to people of all economic, political, cultural, and socioeconomic backgrounds. A prerequisite to a favorable resolution of a CHINS case is treating all parties with dignity and respect. It is important to remember that in the homes of many families living in poverty, love abounds. I find the words of Proverbs chapter 2, verses 2 and 6 as a touchstone for universal respect. The rich and the poor have this in common: the Lord is the maker of them all. Or as Mother Teresa said of the poor, each of them is Jesus in disguise. No discussion of children in the family court system would be complete without mentioning the drug crisis in this state and throughout the country. The hypothetical case I described earlier, when two small children were removed from their home, is based in reality. Is it any wonder that when faced with despair, self-loathing, and fear from deep childhood wounding, that someone might choose to self-medicate their profound pain? Rare is the person whose life is abundant with resources and rich with meaning who wakes up in the morning and thinks, I think I'll crush some OxyContin and snort it today. I've thought long and hard about the statistics I'm about to cite for you. These numbers are hard to hear and incongruous in the beauty of our church, but we need to hear them together. 2015 data from the Vermont Department of Health and the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention put Vermont in the middle of all states at 16.7 drug abuser deaths per 1,000 citizens, far behind such states as West Virginia with 41.5 per 1,000 and New Hampshire, our neighbor, with 31.4 per 1,000, and behind every other New England state. Any consolation, however, derived from our place on that scale is overwhelmed by the fact that overdose deaths in our state rose from 99 in 2015 to 155 in 2016, a percentage increase roughly mirrored by many other states. Think of the preceding numbers and consider this: there was a 30% increase in the children in DCF custody from 2014 to 2016. The U.S. Administration for Children and Family estimates that 683,000 children were victims of abuse and neglect in 2015. Children in the first year of their lives had the highest rate of victimization at 24.2 per 1,000 in the national population of the same age. Sadly, a parent of the child victim was the perpetrator in 78.1% of substantiated cases of child maltreatment. I think you can see that drugs and childhood trauma are inextricably tied together in a cycle that must be broken. How can we find hope in the midst of such depressing numbers? Yes, if not addressed, trauma begets trauma in a generational cycle. But I take heart in the accelerating awareness of the problem. I see it in the curriculum of Columbia Medical School students I do workshops for who are studying the strong correlation between chronic disease and trauma, particularly childhood trauma. As explained in the film Resilience, we are talking about heart disease, diabetes, obesity, cancer, and all manner of autoimmune diseases. I believe that a new day is dawning whereby the need for mental health and wellness is becoming recognized as on a par with the need for physical health. In fact, the two are inextricably linked. I see hope and promise in the dedicated personnel of the family court system, judges, clerks, attorneys, and all of their assistants and aides. I see hope and promise in the social and medical support systems in our state, doctors, nurses, DCF personnel, therapists, social workers, educators, residential treatment center employees, and more, who work tirelessly to help our neighbors survive and thrive. And in my own volunteer contribution of choice, doing the work of a guardian ad litem. Finally, I ask you to consider the words of Psalm 23 for the fourth time today. Often it is read at funerals. It is intended to give strength and comfort to those in grief over the loss of a loved one, as well as to assure us that the recently departed are now dwelling in the house of the Lord forever. There certainly is enough loss and grief in the lives of traumatized children to view Psalm 23 in light of the life they live each day. But I encourage you to look at it slightly differently and use the poetry of the psalmist to give you hope that with the Lord as your shepherd, you can accomplish great work in the smallest of tasks intended to help, guide, and heal the most vulnerable among us. It is a most Christian thing to do.